Group Meeting, Sunday, 18th October, 1981. Last month, we considered in depth the meaning of Samadhi, usually translated into English very inadequately as meditation. The word meditation in the dictionary means musing or concentrating your attention upon some particular subject, generally speaking in connection with religion or philosophy or something like that, meditation. But that is a somewhat inadequate word. It is not musing, it is not meditation in the ordinary English sense of the word. The meditative state is a state, the supreme meditative state is one in which the complete unity with the totality is a realized fact in consciousness. And this implies the disappearance of the ordinary psychophysical functioning in terms of sense perceptions and impressions and discursive thinking and, of course, all words. No words can describe that state, because that state, the context of that state, is the eternal, the infinite, the immortal. And there is no language which can possibly describe that, simply because, and no language can be made to describe that, simply because that state is non-descript. The infinite, having said infinite, there is nothing further to say about it. You can't say it is very large or very small. You can talk about the infinity of the large and the infinity of the small. The conceptual point, for example, is infinite in the sense that it is not finite, it is not measurable. The transcendent context is entirely immeasurable, inconceivable, because our conceptions depend upon the functioning of our brains as such. But the brain is completely still and quiet when one enters that state. Therefore, the transcendent context, which is realized in the supreme meditative state, is one which cannot be known here in our ordinary brain consciousness, as we can know anything which belongs to the finite, the particular, the worldly state. This is a point which we must always bear in mind. We cannot sort of make a picture of the goal of what is that supreme meditative condition. It is transcendent, sufficient. It is sufficient to say that, or it is sufficient to say it is immeasurable and inconceivable. You cannot think about it. Whatever you can, if you can think about anything, that something is an object which is separate from you. It is necessarily finite, temporal, and mortal. It's very important to realize this, because so many illusory paths are pursued in the name of meditation with the hope that you will reach some wonderful transcendental particular state. You will never reach any transcendental particular state as such. It is quite impossible, because particularity is not transcendent. And transcendence is not characterized by particularity. In fact, transcendence has no characteristic at all. It's like space. What characteristic has space? Space is space. We imagine it as a container, but our imagination is illusory, actually. It is it is not exactly a container. It appears to contain. That is our impression through our sense experience and the activity of our brains. We think it is a container, but that which is contained in space, the absolute or the supreme, whatever the ultimate reality is, you see, by its own self-limitation brings into being its own container, and we think that space is that container. You see, there are a tremendous number of illusions and delusions associated with all our religious and spiritual study and our attempt to understand these things. Now, this state of samadhi, which the Christian mystics call the unio mystica, is a state which supervenes. It comes into being for us and through us when the psyche is utterly pure, when it is still and silent. In fact, the whole psychophysical organism becomes still and silent, and as pure as it can possibly become, as pure as it can possibly become. This enables mind in its reality to function freely through us, each and every one of us. We all say, my mind, your mind, his mind, what a brilliant mind, what a stupid mind, and so forth. These are all false ways of talking. There is no such thing as my mind or your mind. Neither you nor I have a mind. Mind is a universal energy. It is a form of the primordial creative energy, which is universal and which is the power that brought and maintains a cosmos out of the original chaos. That is what mind is. It is, perhaps we may ascribe positively, one characteristic to mind, that it is that which makes definite form and purpose for existence. Therefore, there is something like growth and development and so on throughout the entire cosmos. It's not confined to us. It is in the entire cosmos. Some of you, if not all of you, know how Sir Charles Sherrington, in his remarkable book, Man on His Nature, talking about the cell, the physical cell, in chapter 9 of his book, touches upon this point. He says that if the word mind means that which has mind is capable of learning, then we must ascribe mind to a cell, to just a single cell. In fact, I would go very much further in line with the Upanishadic teachers, that consciousness and mind are completely interwoven with every single atom in the universe. The primordial creative energy is identical with consciousness, and it is identical with mind. It is we, because of the way we are constructed and the way we understand things, it is we who limit all this and make a muddle of the whole thing. But otherwise, it is a one thing, a one total absolute reality, a pure reality. The different manifestations, the countless manifestations of that reality, as we apprehend these manifestations in terms of separate things, objects, persons, stars, suns, galaxies, atoms, and all the rest of it. It is we who separate out all these things and try to interpret the wholeness in terms of our separative, limited consciousness. And so we plaster our limitation upon the unlimited and say that the unlimited is so and so. It is nothing of the sort. But in the profounder states of meditation, you will wake up to the meaning of the eternal, to the reality, if one may use such a word, the stuff of eternity. You'll wake up to it. And you will find that your entire world here undergoes a transformation in consequence. It really is a conversion, if you like, of an extraordinary nature altogether. But you have to be a fit psychophysical instrument to stand the consequence of such vision, of such understanding. Otherwise, one can go potty. Now, in all this, we have to appreciate the importance of silence. I mentioned three things: the purity of the psyche, the stillness, and the silence. The three essential things. This importance of the silence has been emphasized in all the great religions of the world. In Zarathustrianism, I think we find the first mention of it, one of the earliest mentions of it. Zarathustra writes, "Silent meditation is the best for spiritual enlightenment." Now note carefully, silent meditation, and of course he uses the Avastan word which corresponds to the Sanskrit samadhi, not the English word meditation. Then in the Psalms, come nearer to our times, the Psalms round about, you know, between 1000 and about 700, 600 or 700 BC. In the Psalms, Psalm 46 verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God." The psalmist had to use the word know, but the word know is an unfortunate word in that context. For us, knowing means knowing with the brain. And all knowing with the brain is conditioned by all our sense experience. Sights, sounds, tastes, touches, smells, and the thinking process, as we call it, which is a silent talking process inside our brains, and it is associated with memory and so forth. All that is at work, and that is the sort of thing we mean by knowing. And it's a very, very poor thing. In fact, it's a very delusive thing vis-à-vis the transcendent reality. So, unfortunately, the psalmist had to use that word because there are no other words in the language to be used. No language supplies the words for the transcendent. Then again, in the Upanishads, we get silence emphasized very, very strongly. Particularly in Upanishads like the Mandukya, the Tejobindu, the Varaha, and others. The Mandukya Upanishad is one of those Upanishads which you'll find in the usual translations of the Upanishads, the translations which are entitled the Major Upanishads or the Great Upanishads. But the Tejobindu and the Varaha and several others, which I know, which I have with me here, they are not to be found in the volume of the Great Upanishads as such. But these particular Upanishads are very, very important because they really supply you with the key to unlock the mysterious, incomprehensible statements of the Great Upanishads. The Buddha, addressing his monks on various occasions, says to them, "Monks, when you are gathered together, you should not, it is unseemly of you to talk about worldly matters. either talk about the Dhamma, the teaching, or maintain the Aryan, the noble silence. Now, what does the silence mean in the Buddhist teaching? It is the silence not only of the tongue. The silence of the tongue was, of course, a preliminary kindergarten practice for all the beginners in the religious life and so forth. But when one started practicing the first steps in with discursive meditation, and that is all that we can do here, we understand what discursive meditation is. You go through a verbal ritual practically. You concentrate your attention upon this, that, or the other, but in the concentration of that attention, you are going through a verbal ritual. Now, the stage comes when that verbal ritual begins to subside, and then finally all thoughts, as we think them, all thoughts and words completely subside. And there is a peace and a purity which you never experienced before in your life. It is absolutely extraordinary. It's indescribable, this peace. It is not a state of unconsciousness or vacuity as some ignorant, extremely learned scholars have declared. It is not that. You are tremendously awake, conscious in a manner such that that which you are conscious of and yourself are a unity. This is the important thing. It is not I as a separate person, the observer, being conscious of the object which I am looking at or listening to or whatever it is. You see? It is not that, but there is a complete, the awareness is one which completely embraces the other within oneself, or the other way around, oneself within the other. There is no such thing as otherness, in other words. in that state of consciousness. And it is in this state that the Aryan silence begins. Remember, begins. There are seven other stages yet before the supreme culmination in the ultimate meditative state is realized. You see, all this has to be borne in mind very carefully. In Christian mysticism, we have wonderful statements and accounts of the origin of quiet. You know how in Christian mysticism it is divided into three sections, recollection, quiet, and then contemplation. And under contemplation come also rapture and ecstasy. The Christian mystics always talked in terms of ecstasy. I think ecstasy is an incorrect word. It is not an ecstasy. It is an enstasy. E-N-S-T-A-C-Y. Enstasy. Ecstasy is a word which has its real meaning in terms of being beside yourself, outside yourself. You are not outside yourself. You are entirely yourself, but not separatively, isolatively self-conscious of yourself. This is the important thing to bear in mind, you see. In this intense quiet, this absolute poise, this imperturbable state of the mind, you see, the tatra majjatata. state. In that condition, you are the instrument through which the cosmos realizes its whole unity with you. It is not I, John Smith, or Mary Brown, who am realizing or achieving or attaining. Nothing of the sort. You or I just don't attain or achieve nothing. What we do attain is the full manifestation of our own no-thingness, of our own nothingness. The Christian mystics have used this word nothingness, and you'll find it, of course, in the Upanishadic teachings and in the Buddha's teachings too. He talks of the state of nothingness in the third Samapatti as such. So the silence is of utmost importance, and yet it's a very interesting thing to notice how unsilent, if I may say such a thing, how unsilent all of us are. Chatter, chatter, chatter endlessly. We can't do such a simple thing as to shut up. And yet, all through our school days particularly, we have been told one of the supreme teachings which the religious teachers have told us from the schoolmaster when he shouts at us, "Shut up! Be quiet, everybody!" That's just what we don't do, just what we cannot do. And if we can't do it with our tongues, we shall never do it in reality also, simply because the tongue merely gives forth, the voices forth, the activity of the brain. It's the brain which is the non-stop chatterer. You see? Now, there is nothing sinful or evil in that chatter, unless, of course, that chatter is planning murder or destruction or etc., etc., if it's anything like that. But the chattering means that the psyche is in a state of turmoil. And in a state of turmoil, this, what the Buddha called the sublime unoriginated nirvana, that peace which is beyond all understanding, as it is put in Christian terms, the peace of God which passeth all understanding, cannot supervene. Because we are preventing it. We are the noisemakers in the cosmos. Yes, it's an extraordinary thing that nothing in the cosmos is a noisemaker like we human beings are. But there we are. So, we can appreciate the importance of this silence. If we learn to talk less and less, we will listen more and more. And in that listening, there will grow real understanding and real relationship with the person who is talking to us. Listen to him, you see. And if we listen like that, we form a unity with that person, a state of unity, which prevents the state of enmity which naturally prevails between most people. It is an extraordinary fact that a man and his neighbor, there is always this sort of moving away from him. Who are you? What do you want? That sort of attitude, isn't there? There isn't a poise. Or there is a sort of a immediate attraction and they fall into each other's arms or bump their heads together or whatever as a sign of their affection or something like that. Not at all. Can't they just be themselves, just all right, poised and in complete relationship without any noise making? You see, so many things are involved in all this. Now, just a few words about the significance of the pure state of the psyche and its implications. If and when the psyche is pure, then all the defilements, the mental defilements, are out. And you can make a very, very long list of all the defilements from which we human beings suffer. All of them are out. Second, there is no reaction from that person. This is a very important thing. I don't think, I haven't come across it written anywhere. There is no reaction from that person to any stimulus, a reaction of lust and greed, of anger, envy, malevolence, hate, violence, fear. There is complete freedom from all illusions and delusions. When the psyche is pure, it's empty of all the delusions which we have clung to and the illusions that we have manufactured during our lifetime. There is no stupid action by that person, no vested interest in anything whatsoever. The Buddha, for instance, when he talks of and you'll find this in the writings of the mystics too, when he talks of the arahat, he gives nine special points which distinguish the arahat. He is incapable of any sort of partiality, of acting through partiality or fear or stupidity. That's a very important point. Everyone in the world likes to think himself very canny and very sensible and so forth. But it would be really difficult to find even 100 truly sensible people in the whole world. To be truly sensible implies that one has trained one's senses in the right way and allows them to function in the right way. You see. Now that is it's very rare to find a person of that sort. If the senses are trained and are perfect instruments of the living being, the right sort of instrument, then that person is the person who is rightly called a meek person. That is the meaning of meekness. Not being namby-pamby or spineless. You see? Its origin is Greek, praos, and it was applied to the situation where when a young colt was tamed, he was tamed first and then he was trained. Tamed so that he would begin to obey his master. And then he was trained to do what his master wanted him to do. You see? And that was the meaning of the word, of the verb, to be meeked, to be made meek. You see? So we have to be tamed. The taming has to be done by us, over all our appetites and whims and fancies and passions and impulses and all the things with which the human race is plagued. You see, we have to tame that first within ourselves. And then so use the senses intelligently, constantly intelligently, that the senses are really trained to observe. We think we look carefully when we are looking at something, we don't. You know that lovely story, it is a fact actually, in the last century, in France, at the Sorbonne, a student went to and applied to be under a professor, I think for biology or some such scientific subject. So the professor said, all right. And he said, well, look, take this object, examine it, and give a written description of what you have seen. So the student came back in a few minutes with a little description. The professor read through it very carefully, and he said, look at it again, and take a longer time. The student spent some hours and produced a few more pages about it. The professor said, that's better, but look again. And the third time, the student produced almost a little book on the whole thing. And he was astonished to discover what a poor looker he was. He just didn't look. Now you see, when you train the senses that way, then the sense activities no longer obstruct vision, no longer obstruct insight. And mind in its purity, in its greatness, begins to function. And remember, mind is a universal power, a universal energy. That's why I said earlier on, if the organism isn't properly trained, if the mind were to function freely through us, it would shatter us. So now, no stupid action and no vested interest. We all like to imagine we are such unselfish people wanting just to do the right thing, the good thing, help our fellow human beings, to serve God and all the rest of the claptrap. But it really is just claptrap. If we examine ourselves really carefully, and we have to become capable of examining ourselves, capable of looking at ourselves, of listening to ourselves and so on. If we look very, very carefully, we will find it almost impossible to be free of some sort of vested interest in the whole process. Oh no, I don't want anything for myself, I only want to serve God. But I never inquire first of all, does God need my service? He did very well without me for at least 5,000 million years, or maybe 20,000 million years, if the Big Bang theory is to be accepted, when the cosmos started off. 20,000 million years he did very well. Does he need my service? And I shall be here serving him, of course, wonderfully, in my own imagination, for 60, 70 years, perhaps. And then he'll do very well, perhaps better, without me. These are the sort of things that we must open our eyes to. And that clears out all false conceit, on the one hand, and sometimes a false sense of inferiority or self-depreciation on the other. Neither of those extremes are any use at all. They're a nuisance. First and foremost, to those around us, and also to ourselves. So, there must be no vested interest of any sort. Why? Because a vested interest is something defined by my imperfect brain. I have some desire, something which I long to possess or achieve or something, and I make a picture of what it would like to be. I would like it to be, you see. Well, of course, that defeats the whole exercise altogether. It's no use doing that. Just let be. When you or I were born, did we have any idea that, I should like to grow up like this and that and the other? I should like to be a six-footer. I should like to be a great poet. I should like to be one of the great train robbers. Any such nonsense? Did we have any such idea? Not at all. We just grew up, didn't we? And what made us grow up? Just the life energy, fed and supported by the parents, by light, by warmth, by air, and so on and so on. And it all happens naturally. And insofar as we obstruct the natural happening, we are destroying ourselves. Now, that is much more intensely so with regard to the religious life and the spiritual life. We must let this mysterious primordial creative energy work itself out through us. Our business is to be so observant, that is why the trained senses are necessary to start with. We must be so observant that we get some sort of inkling of the direction in which this creative energy is moving us. It will come to fruition through us as the perfected human, the true human. And remember always, the word human means fundamentally the blissful creator. That's the full meaning of the word human, the blissful creator. It is the term we apply to God. Divinity is our potential. That is why God has been worshipped through the ages. It is that word represents our divine potential. And because there have been through the ages some who have realized it and taught others about it and therefore made their lives more fruitful and happy, therefore this worship of the Supreme has been something which has characterized the whole history of the human race. Well, now we have touched upon some of the implications of the pure state of the psyche. That takes us a long way, actually. And we can see that we are not exactly in that state, are we, at present? Some of you maybe, I don't know. But you see, it is the sort of state which we ascribe to the saint, the perfected Holy One. But that is the starting point. Saintship is the beginning of the religious life and spiritual fruition. It's the beginning. It's not the end point. Now, for us, our starting point is mindfulness. We have to be mindful. And you know, the Buddha said, Sama Sati. Sati is mindfulness. Sama is perfect. Perfect mindfulness. Jesus said, watch and pray. Watch, not the traffic in Piccadilly Circus, but watch the traffic which is going on inside one's own head. Particularly that traffic. Our thoughts and our feelings, our reactions, the uprising of all our passions and appetites and so forth, the whole thing. Watch every single action. The way we eat, for example, what we eat and drink and so forth. Because all this is related to the purity of the body as such, which is essential. Watch everything, how we move, how we talk, how we dress, every single thing. Watch it carefully and watch in the bigger sense too. All that is going on around, and watching it, let us understand it. Not criticize it, not condemn it, nor appraise it. Because if we praise this, that, or the other, we generally identify ourselves with what we like and praise, and we become conceited. And this conceit is a very subtle influence in our lives. It's absolutely extraordinary how difficult it is to get free of this conceit. We all have a strong ego sense, and we cling to that ego. I am a good fellow, of course. It's the other chap who is doing all the bad things. When we really practice mindfulness in its fullness, we begin to know ourselves for what we really are, and we begin to know the world for what it is. observe the fact. This is evil, this is good, and so forth. Observe the fact. But neither condemn nor identify yourself with what you think is the good. Both of them will undergo transformation. The good as well as the evil undergoes transformation into the absolute good. I have to use a phrase like absolute good because there is no third word to represent the integration into perfection which emerges out of complete understanding of either of the duals, either of the opposites. That is why I have to use a term like absolute good. Our spiritual values, as we call them, love, beauty, and goodness, and truthful, fidelity, and all the rest of it. All these things as spiritual values are the absolute of what in our ordinary ambivalent state are just one of the two duals. Good, bad, love, hate, kindness, cruelty, generosity, meanness, and so on. You see? It's like that. So now, this mindfulness reveals to us what we are, what the world is, and we wake up to our complete interrelationship with the world. This we must never try to avoid or escape, because it is a natural tendency in all of us to say, no, I'm not like that, I have nothing to do with it, etc., etc., I never did anything wrong, and so forth. We are completely interactive and interrelated in actual fact. And if we can truly awaken to that, then compassion in the real sense can grow in us, and wisdom. Wisdom meaning that kind of understanding and perception which enables us to do the right thing, carry the right action in any and every circumstance, by which we will not hurt anybody else at all at any time. You see, this is important. So, purity and peace permeates one's whole being. An inner peace which nothing will shake, inner peace and poise. You know how the Buddha said, the goal of the religious life, the holy life, the brahmacharya, is none of the worldly things, not even the attainment of great mental powers and so forth, but unshakable freedom of mind. Now the Buddha always used the word mind, and as a matter of fact, the word psyche has come into general use only in our own century. The Greeks had the word psyche, but they didn't use the word psyche in the way we are using it now, you see. Psyche is this which is specifically yours. It represents your own thoughts, feelings, your intellectual, emotional states and activities and so forth. Psyche is all that. Your psychical life and your psychical functioning. You see? But in those days they didn't have the word psyche in India. So they always used the word mind, which is misleading. Because later on they saw that there was a difference, so they talked about pure mind. They talked of Chidatma, for instance, in the Upanishads. And what was the Mahayana word? Do you know, Peter? Mind, pure mind. Pure mind, mind only. Just Chitta. Is it?
There's two translations into English, and sometimes they say heart, sometimes they say mind.
But there is a word, and I've just forgotten it. Never mind.
It's bodhicitta.
No. That's something different.
Purusha, that's the purity of the person, is it? Purusha.
No. Purusha
is
something.
I know it's not that, but that is. person is dead.
Purusha means person. Yes. But what sort of a person? The person in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. That is the meaning of Purusha, and that is the real significance of person. And it is not related to personality, because personality, the word personality is related to persona, which is a mask, which is an outward appearance you put on. You see, it's a deceiver, personality. It's as actually, personality is the usurper of the true person. The true person is divinity embodied. Now, when we practice meditation, or hope to practice meditation in depth, we will come across all sorts of obstructions and difficulties. And I will try and deal with some of them at our next meeting. We'll stop here now for the time being.